Thanks. Yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me. Like coming by, see all my friends. Okay, so yeah, I'm going to be talking about ultralight axions. First of all, a little tour of axion masses in general and what they do. So all the way down at 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, you've got the Hubble scale. And all the way up at 10 to the 23 electron volts, you've got axion inflation, natural inflation. And then you've got everything in between. You've got effects on you've got effects on early universe cosmology from axions produced thermally that decay and have effects on BBN. And then as you start to get lighter and lighter, you start to have effects on late universe cosmology. So you start to have guys that no longer behave like dark matter and affect linear scales such as the CMB, which I'll discuss a little bit. And you might have effects on high redshift galaxy formation, black hole super radiance, and you can start thinking about direct detection in certain mass ranges. And I'm going to focus on this mass range here, which I term ultralight axions, which I mean kind of, you know, anything lighter than a Planck-coupled QCD axion. And they're particularly interesting in this range of masses around 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 20 or so EV, as being relevant to small-scale structure formation distinct from cold dark matter. And, you know, how might we feasibly directly detect axions in that mass range? Okay, so the motivation for these very light axions, as I said, is effects on dark matter substructure. And this appears to select, you know, some kind of preferred mass range around 10 to the minus 22 EV for reasons that I will explain briefly. Why might this mass range be selected? Well, one reason why it might be selected is the so-called cusp core problem in dwarf spheroidal galaxies. So here I'm showing just one version of seeing this problem as presented by Walker and Penarubia in 2011. So what they did is they looked at stars in Sculptor and Fornax, and there are two chemodynamically distinct populations of stars in both of these dwarf galaxies. And from simulations, there's an empirical relationship between the velocity dispersion of stars at their half-light radius and the mass enclosed within the half-light radius. And so by analyzing each population of stars separately, they were able to put constraints on the mass enclosed within the half-light radius for each population. And so this directly measures the slope of the dark matter density profile between those two radii. And in blue is the slope that you would expect if the density profile was cuspy, like an NFW profile that you expect from CDM. And in red is the slope that you would expect if the density profile is cored. And so, you know, you can look at their data, and it lies very nicely on what you get for a core and not what you get for a cusp. And the way they state this is they say that they exclude an NFW-type cusp at greater than 99% confidence level. I put a question mark in cusp core problem in dwarf spheroidals because I don't want to take too much of like a strong position on whether or not this is really, you know, some problem with cold dot matter. But at least the way it's presented here, it appears to show that dwarf galaxies are cored, or at least that something is going on that is not collisionless dark matter only on scales of around a kiloparsec.
Could be baryons.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean. It's not collisionless dark matter only on scales of a kiloparsec. Feedback is kind of hard to arrange in a dwarf spheroidal because they're so dark matter dominated. So it would have to be something early on in the history. So like lots of supernova feedback when the dwarfs are formed and then all the baryons get blown out or something like that. So the other motive, why might really light axions have something to do with cores in dwarf galaxies? So these are some really fantastic simulations done by a Taiwanese group, Shive et al. It's a terrible title, I think, but ignore the title. Really amazing simulations. They simulated a light scalar field, mass of order 10 to the minus 22 EV, right from, you know, redshift of 900 all the way down to today. And the structure formation proceeds on large scales exactly as cold dark matter. You've got this oscillating field and it just behaves like matter. But on small scales, you start to see the gradient energy of the field become important. And you form, so you've got an NFW halo on large scales and you've got the cosmic web like this. But as you zoom in, as they do adaptive mesh refinement on their simulations, you start to see that in the centers of halos, you have cores. and they're shown like this. So they're these particularly prominent cores that stick up out of the NFW piece, but then they're flat. And you see this in a variety of galaxies found in their simulation at various different redshifts. Okay, so there's a core, and its field gradient energy. It's just classical fields with large occupation numbers as gradient energy. I don't know if it's really quantum interference, but it's a fantastic paper. Well, I don't think it's a quantum effect. I think it's it's classical wave interference. I don't think there's any quantum mechanics going on in there. Okay, but how can you understand what they saw in those simulations roughly? So all it is it's a non-relativistic limit of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon equation, gives you the Schrodinger-Poisson equation. And the I just comes because I've got something oscillating as e to the I omega t. Okay, so it looks like a Schrodinger equation, but it's sourced by the field itself, the potential is sourced by the field itself by the Poisson equation. It's a classical field. The wave function here is actually just the oscillation averaged axion field, and the axion field is the density is the modulus squared of this field, and the axion field is this plus its complex conjugate. Now this field, psi, the equation of motion, has localized stable oscilloton solutions. They're a type of soliton, and you can find them just by solving this equation in spherical symmetry with particular boundary conditions. And you find these stable self-gravitating solitons. They have a scaling symmetry, so you only need to solve the equations once, and then the size is just related to the central density. And that's also related to the gene scale of this field in linear theory. It's pressure supported, it's like any star. Why a star is spherical, pressure support. And they're also, this line down here is that solution. They're found in simulation. But they're spherical just because it's pressure supported. Okay, so the dark matter halos that are found in this simulation, what do they look like? So because the Schrodinger equation, the wave equation, looks like cold dark matter above the gene scale, it's the basis of the Widrow-Kaiser approach, you must have some kind of transition on large scales between these solitons and an NFW profile.
Okay, hold on a second. I have a question. So people talk about Bose-Einstein condensates for axions.
Yeah.
That would be a quantum effect, right? So is this completely different? So what's the relationship between these?
Well, so the quantum bit is only just how do you get into that condensate in the first place. So if you start with a bunch of particles and then it has to condensate, and it has to condense. It is and it isn't, right. So the Bose-Einstein condensate question really, I think it's Sasha Davidson wrote some really good papers on this. You think, okay, there's two populations of axions. There's a population that's created by vacuum realignment from a field that is stretched and made homogeneous by inflation. That is a condensate right from the get-go.
Sure.
And then that just oscillates. The Bose-Einstein condensate question is rather for the population of axions that are created after inflation, for example, by the decay of a topological defect. Then you've got a whole bunch of particles, and then you have to ask whether they condense into the ground state.
I thought there was also the issue of, you know, the Bose-Einstein condensate doesn't stay like this because then you have structure formation in that.
Right, so you only local.
So condensate, so I think the issue of whether it actually remains.
Right, so you're just gravitational clustering obviously takes you out of the homogeneous mode, but you're locally in the local ground state. That's where those solitons are. But on large scales, you've got the cosmic web and the structure formation. So, but this is all just take a classical field that's been stretched by inflation, and it's in the condensate because that's what it was from the get-go. That's the initial conditions.
Okay.
So these density profiles. That were found in those simulations, and you can guess the form of from knowing about solitons and knowing about ordinary hierarchical structure formation. It should be this soliton-like profile in the center, and then an NFW profile in the outer parts, and they transition between one another at some fraction epsilon of the central density. And because of that scaling relationship that I told you about before, there's a relationship between the soliton radius and the central density, so they're fixed entirely by the central density. So there are three parameters per halo if you wanted to try and fit these density profiles to the dwarf spheroidal observations. Three parameters per halo compared to two for NFW, because you've got the central density, which is related to the size, you've got the scale radius, and you've got the matching between the NFW and the soliton. You've then got one global parameter, which is the particle mass. So, so the goal is to constrain the parameters of these profiles by fitting to data, and taking the mass as a global parameter. So we did that. This is work in progress with Jorge Peña-Rubio at Edinburgh and Alma González-Morales in Mexico. Okay, so we looked at the 8 classical dwarf spheroidals, Fornax, Sculptor, Draco, Leo 1, Leo 2, Sextans, Carina, Ursa Minor. And we fitted the line of sight velocity dispersion profile using these density profiles and took the axion mass as a global parameter. Okay, in the first analysis, we just fitted them individually, in fact. We took the mass as a free parameter for each galaxy. Obviously, that's not the case, but it's an interesting exercise. And so this is just kind of standard. We did a Monte Carlo results plot. And you pick out some particular value of the mass. You only see the cores in any individual galaxy that fit well by a core. And so all those parameters to do with the scale radius and the matching to the NFW are unconstrained when you look at a single galaxy. And so that's what these fuzzy bits are here. They're your unconstrained parameters. But you very well constrain the axial mass and the central density because it's a core. When you do a joint analysis, combining the likelihoods of all of these in an equal weight to, in this first version, then because you demand that the mass is a global parameter for each of the 8 galaxies, you start to have to fit the outer parts of the density profile, because there's one mass that's got to be consistent for them all, and so you start to need that extra freedom to fit the density profiles.
I think you said this, but the fit you're saying is like it's NFW outside, some radius, and then it's the core.
And then it's a core inside.
Are you getting that by you have some sort of a system where you solve and you find that's the solution, or is this kind of a model for what's
it's a fit, just like NFW is a fit to the observed density profiles. The soliton shape is a fit to the observed numerical profile, and we just match those two.
But the NFW part of it is dark matter coming from the axions too, right?
Yes.
So do you have kind of one solution to the axion equations, which is giving you both, or is it
so if you solve just, in vacuum, if you just say, like, I'm in the ground state, you just get the solitons.
Yeah.
But because of hierarchical structure formation on scales larger than the gene scale, if you do a cosmological evolution, you find the NFW profiles on the outside. So that comes from...
Yes or no? So does it mean you've got one solution that doesn't both, or you have kind of two solutions which you think apply different regimes, and then you match them phenomenologically?
Well, so they're found in the simulations.
Sorry.
So they have a solution, right, that is both. But the matching that we're doing is just that their profiles are fit by these two pieces. So it's just a fit.
Yeah.
One thing you can do is you can check whether these things are stable. So, we take that profile and we put some stars in it and we check that the orbits make sense and we do a bunch of mocks.
The one way to think about it is that it just acts like you just have an incoherent space of axions going around.
Right, exactly.
And then because of the uncertainty principle in the middle, I cannot go around, so that cuts off the middle part.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so are we saying I thought. At least classically, there weren't solutions like this. I could be wrong.
Well, I mean, they're not stable, right? But they're stable on cosmological timescales.
But are we saying it's not one model classically in the middle?
No. All you do is you take the classical field equations, you give them cosmological initial conditions, and you solve them on a computer, and this is what you find. And you find profiles like that. So they must exist and they must be stable on cosmological timescales because they're found numerically.
That seems amazing, right? But keep going.
What's naive about solving things on a computer?
A numerical solution. That alone is not enough to say that they actually exist.
And then you just find
out
an equation and then
it's
a solution.
Yeah, no, but usually these things diverge in the middle.
No.
But they don't, they're smooth. They're regular.
How many actual free parameters do you have?
So in this, there are 3 parameters per galaxy plus the mass, which is a global one.
Four to fit the data for
3 plus a global, which is the same for all 8.
So you should be, there's 24
parameters. There's 25 parameters.
You should be able to fit the data with 3 parameters.
But each galaxy doesn't have the same scale radius. All galaxies are formed, they're environmentally dependent. Just like each solar system doesn't have the same number of planets. Okay, and then so from that, you can constrain the mass. And this is where you pick up this lovely mass, 10 to the minus 22 EV. So what I'm showing here is the posterior, marginalized posterior on the mass. So in color are the ones for each galaxy individually. So you see Fornax and Sculptor really pick out their cores. They're clearly cored. They pick out this mass very well. Some of the other galaxies don't really have any particular preference. The data has no preference for cores over cusps particularly. But there are galaxies that are larger. There are galaxies that are, which way around does it go? There are smaller galaxies like Sextant, and there are larger galaxies like Draco, and the size is kind of picking out masses, and you're driven to this kind of global compromise value. Okay.
So it's about 1 year that it takes to oscillate.
It's 2.5 months. I'm going to get to that. Okay. So we're testing a whole bunch of this stuff against mocks. Why did we pick out a slightly different value of the mass than you would if I did just slopes analysis, which I've done before? Why is it slightly different? How is it different in each galaxy if you combine the stars into a single population or multiple populations? How does that bias your results? Does your method really recover things from the, as you expect it to? So we've got mocks of each galaxy, and we apply our method, and we see whether we can get out the input parameters. There's lots of things like that we're testing. Yes, Andrew?
Maybe you said already, what was the prior on M22?
So the prior on the mass, we take a log flat prior on the mass.
Cut off at what values?
We cut off at a value. I think we cut off at 10 to the minus 18 EV, so where you should be well looking like CDM.
So it's out of the room somewhere to the right.
Yeah. But there is an issue about the how our profiles continuously, they do go to continuously to NFW, but it's whether or not our parameterization lets you get there. And so that's something that we're exploring in our mocks as well. Is mocking up NFWs using different and seeing which ones have the right is the right parameterization to get back what you want. But as I said, this is work in progress, especially as it comes to the mocks.
Yeah. I'm asking part because I'm slightly puzzled that the black combined line seems to be really driven by the green curve.
Right, it's driven by Sculptor.
Ignoring the Fornax, which on the face of it looks the best constrained.
So these. I haven't checked that they're normalized in exactly the same way. This was just like me extracting the posteriors roughly.
Sure.
So I don't know if the normalization is done. I think it should be. So yeah, it's odd that Fornax doesn't, that Sculptor drives it. But I mean, you've also got all these other galaxies that really don't want to be at particularly low mass. So we're looking at how it all gets combined together, and we combine these all with the same weight, but the data might be better or worse in different galaxies. So another thing we're looking at is a study where we take the weights of each galaxy and the likelihood as a hyperparameter. So that's something that might give us some more information about that.
So Kevin, do you have something like a reduced chi-square?
No.
Okay. Very useful to see that these are actually good. Is there a good fit?
Right.
Because, you're going to get something, but that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be...
Right. And you know, you're fitting parameters of a model that you're extracting. We're not trying to say whether this is preferred over NFW in this case. Because I don't think that you can, because there's this famous thing called the beta degeneracy when it comes to fitting dwarves. And we're kind of seeing that in our mocks. So you're fitting a model assuming that it's true in some sense, I think. We're worried about this at the moment. And it's one of these things that people worry about in the Gaia Challenge all the time. Like, can you really recover density profiles by doing genes analysis?
think that's an interesting question. The NFW proper, should we consider that to be recovered for sufficiently large N22?
Yes.
Because your curve, if I look at Fornax's curve, you appear to rule out large N22 at more sigma than you possibly can. So the implication is the NFW really fails so drastically that if you just look at the picture of it, it obviously be wrong.
So it's kind of, I mean, Fornax definitely selects that pretty well, and that's like this Walker and Peña-Rubio thing that, you know, appears to exclude a central cusp at, like, you know, greater than 99% confidence.
Well, this is much, much greater than 99% confidence already. You're ruling out pretty large N22 that's
right.
Sigma or something.
Yeah, and so that's an issue. You know, what is the limit? So the limit in this part... Yeah, it looks like you're excluding it at very, very sigma. But that might not be the best way to express whether you're excluding that. I mean, maybe, you know, if you instead sampled in 1 over n, right?
Yeah, that's why I was interested to ask about the prior you would choose.
Mm-hmm.
If you choose a log prior, as you've done,
mm-hmm.
you're putting a lot of the initial prior mass towards the low end
mm-hmm.
as well. On the other hand, you're using a very wide range, so you also have a lot of models at the high end, which you could sample.
Yeah. So do you think we should maybe look at a linear prior on M?
Don't know. I suppose you have to ask a string theorist.
Some string axis on mass, I'm sure, there are plenty of answers to that.
So we'll
get very different answers.
And there is this limit of like what limit do we approach NFW? So it's not just the limit that the mass goes to infinity, it's a limit that the mass goes to infinity and the central density goes up with it in a certain way in the parameterization we've chosen. So that is an issue, and that's something that we're exploring with the MUX.
Also, these things are not going to be Gaussians, right? So you can't just look at how many central widths it is away from it and say that. He's going to have very heavy tails to the right.
Probably. The Fornax doesn't appear to have a heavy tail.
No, that's what
it's
worth.
Yeah, Fornax doesn't.
It probably does work the other one.
So that means that some, that is a bit off.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm fundamentally saying is that, you know, if the Fornax data was good enough to give you that curve, everyone would long ago have agreed that this is a catastrophic problem with Fornax CDM. The fact that they haven't all said that probably means that they don't really believe the error bars that the data has given, and that NFW is not nearly as ruled out as it appears to be by the data. And in the future, we'll find out who's right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's why I kind of don't. I'm not taking like a stance on whether this is excluding or not, because I don't really understand the details of that. And it's something that Jorge is particularly worried about. Okay, so there's this nice low mass that appears to look good from substructure. Is it consistent cosmologically? Yes. So on the left is the optical depth reionization computed in these models from the halo mass function as a function of the axion mass. The error on the theory band, which is the orange band, is the modeling uncertainty. It's the astrophysical uncertainty, so over a range of models. It looks like if you carried on going to higher mass, this would eventually go outside of the Planck measurements of tau, but it doesn't because the astrophysical uncertainty on modeling realization blows up as you get closer towards CDM. And that's because there's lots of uncertainty on what's the minimum halo mass for star formation, what's the escape fraction of neutral hydrogen, what's the star formation efficiency rate, all of these kind of things. So when you get to CDM, the bands on that become very large. But we're consistent with a low optical depth of reionization. The pink line is that best fit value from the dwarves. We're also consistent with an estimate of the amount of substructure. It looks kind of spookily consistent in this plot, and I wouldn't put too much weight on that because this is a semi-analytic model for substructure. It's not coming from any simulations, and I just look and Lovell et al. Claim, you know, a conservative lower bound than the amount of substructure is 66 subhalos in the Milky Way. And so I've just computed the subhalo mass function.
What is that based on? Is that Lovell et al.?
Lovell, they estimate the 66. I don't know where they choose their 66, but they were doing simulations trying to test models of warm dark matter, and they ruled out, and they said a model was, you know, disfavored if it produced fewer than 66 sort of halos in the Milky Way.
Okay.
And then here I've taken a kind of extended press Schecter model to compute the subhalo mass function. Okay, looks kind of consistent. Nice. I'm going to skip this because we're all still just in my introduction, by the way. okay, there's this nice mass, 10 to minus 22 EV. It appears consistent with cosmology. It may solve some small scale structure problems. How the hell can you get it? Can you build a model where you get such a low mass? So that's what I want to talk about now. Okay, so what we're going to try and do in this model is have a...
Why wouldn't a non-interacting scalar field be a bad candidate? You don't need to say word axiom, right, in this business. I mean, it could be just a scalar field, but...
With a mass.
Right, with a mass.
Right, right. So I want to start talking about, yeah... direct detection, a bit of model building.
Okay,
then I'm going to start saying, you know, what are the couplings? It's going to have axion-like couplings.
In previous discussion, there's no sign of any coupling to the standard model.
No,
right? I mean,
exactly.
At all, right?
So in previous, it could be...
The minimal assumption would be no coupling to the standard model. It would be just as
fine. Yep. But I want to try and talk about direct detection and things.
So the idea is ultralight things that haven't been seen yet, but might be seen soon.
Yep. Okay, so I'm going to try and build a model where this is an axion. Okay, so I'm going to have a model where I've got two axions. I've got the QCD axion, which I'm going to use to solve the strong CP problem, and I've got this ultralight axion, which I'm going to demand is the dominant component of the dark matter. So I'm going to introduce two standard model singlet compact scalars and two axial symmetries, U1PQ, U1ULA, and the decay constants are the VEVs of these scalars. I choose the charge assignments of the standard model quarks and H up, H down, such that the ultralight axion has zero color anomaly, so it gets no mass from QCD. What I'm calling the QCD axion has a color anomaly, gets its mass from QCD, solves the strong CP problem. But then we're going to ask, okay, how can I have this really light mass? Okay, so these are global symmetry. These are continuous global symmetries. You expect breaking of continuous global symmetries by UV effects like quantum gravity, and these will contribute to the masses of these particles. So I'm going to consider this operator here giving mass to my axion, to my ultralight axion. So that could, in general, give you some large mass. And so in order to try and control the order at which that operator appears, I'm going to impose an exact global discrete symmetry. And so that these two symmetries are just accidental and a consequence of this exact Zn global symmetry. So this restricts the order at which that operator can appear. And so if I have these charge assignments, so N and M are the charges of H down and X2 under this discrete symmetry, then that puts a restriction on the order P at which X2 can appear. And so then you can work out the scale of the potential that arises from that. And it depends on P, that power. So I'm just going to choose N, M, and P such that I can get out the low mass that I want and the large decay constant. And so you plug in some fiducial values for these things. These are sine beta and cos beta for the Higgs up, Higgs down, electroweak scale, M3 halves. Okay, so you find that this axion mass over 10 to the minus 22 EV, I fix a fiducial value of its decay constant at 10 to the 17, and for the QCD axion at 10 to the 11. And that's so that I get out the dark matter abundances that I want without any fine tuning. So without any more than 1% fine tuning. So this mass gives you more than 90% of the dark matter if the decay constant is 10 to the 17 GeV. The QCD axion gives you less than 10% of the dark matter without having to tune too much if you're 10 to the 11 GeV.
So how do you produce
axiom?
Vacuum realignment. Okay, so this is the mass. It's got this parameter P here, and I have some equation that tells me how to find P based on my discrete symmetry.
So currently the web for the axiom, what's the value for 10 minus 42?
What do you mean? The VEV of the angular part or the VEV of the real part?
No, oh, well, the not the VEV, but let's say the amplitude of
the amplitude?
Right, should just take the dark matter density.
Yeah, so it's like 10 to the 10 GeV.
10 to the 10.
Yeah. Okay. If you take the dark matter density and you take that mass, it's 10 to the 10 GeV. Okay, so if I take my discrete symmetry at n equals 24, then I can do this in an example model. N equals 24, m equals 8, n equals 14. I get a mass of 2.8 times 10 to the minus 22 EV with these chosen fiducial values for the decay constants. I can instruct the whole family of models like this by varying n. And so here, well, I'm varying p, which is just n plus 1. Here, and you get a relationship between the ULA decay constant and the mass, just from here. And these are the models. Capital N is the ZN symmetry. So it's very, you know, high order discrete symmetries, but you can do it. And so the color is just the value of P here. And the black lines that I've shown here are the region that you want to live in if you want to get the relic abundance such that this light particle dominates the dark matter, the QCD axion is subdominant, and you haven't got any more than 1% fine tuning with these decay constants. So you live in here. So okay, great, you can construct such a model.
So is symmetry non-nonless?
Is it
if I understand right, nothing touching your discrete symmetry.
Yeah, it's assumed global.
The global part is you're breaking with box press operators that are still consistent with.
It doesn't break the discrete symmetry, it only breaks the approximate continuous symmetry.
Yeah, but nothing's touching the discrete.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, is the discrete symmetry the gauge effect?
I don't know.
Oh.
I haven't thought about it. Okay, so you can construct such a model where you get light axions that have this attractive range of masses and will dominate the dark matter density from vacuum realignment production. How do these two axions in this model couple to the standard model, and how might you detect them? So the QCD axion in this model is a DFSZ type, has electromagnetic and color anomalies, has tree-level fermion couplings, and, you know, for example, it has this standard axion E dot B coupling, which is suppressed by 1 over the decay constant. The ultralight axion in this model, it turns out for the charge assignments we took to make it free of the color anomaly, it also turns out that it has no electromagnetic anomaly, so it has no coupling to E dot B, and no coupling to the electric dipole moment via the usual QCD coupling. But it does have tree-level fermion couplings. That's how I arranged that it was anomaly-free. And so it has these tree-level couplings to the axial nucleon currents, which scale with 1 over the decay constant, and this order 1 parameter you can compute, and it's order 1.
It's very small
coupling,
right?
Yeah, because F is 10 to the 17 GeV, so it's small.
There isn't much of spin-dependent forces from that.
Right, there's not much spin-dependent forces, but I'm going to say that, you know, there might be a way to get it from the axion wind.
No way.
We'll see. And you can tell me what you think about the low frequency extrapolation that I'm going to do. Okay, so what are the constraints on axions from their interactions? Well, I'm actually doing much better than I thought. I'm only halfway through. Okay. So that's one model, and I have a coupling to this axial nucleon current for my light dark matter, and I don't have a coupling to E dot B or to the neutron electric dipole moment. But let's start thinking, like, you know, just a little bit more broadly, what are the constraints on axion-like particles from their interactions? So the standard the standard searches all rely on the E.B constraints. So again, it's this operator phi couples to FF dual, which just looks like E.B. Then you have this Primakov process. Axion comes in, hits some external magnetic field, turns into a photon, you detect the photon. This is a summary of those constraints. So this is the coupling, G gamma. That was about 10 to the minus 16 inverse GeV. You have these constraints from helioscopes, which is searching for axions coming from the sun, which kind of just about get onto the QCD axion line, which is this yellow band. The improvements with the International Axion Observatory will eat further into there. And then you've got ADMX, which is a kind of pointed search for axion dark matter, and that will get into this kind of classic axion window here. But notice that the mass on this scale cuts off at about 10 to the minus 8 eV, which is, you know, the decay constant at roughly 10 to the 13 GeV for a QCD axion. So the QCD axion in the model that I just showed you would kind of live somewhere here, but because it's a subdominant component of the dark matter, it would maybe not be pick-upable by ADMX in quite the same way. But how does ADMX work? ADMX is the kind of poster child axion dark matter experiment. It's what's called a haloscope, originally proposed by Sakivi in 1983, and directly detects axions using a microwave cavity and a B field. It's able to get the mass very precisely if they were to detect axions, and that's because it's a resonant cavity experiment. But it's limited because you require resonance. You want the size of the cavity to be avoided the Compton wavelength of the axion, and so you're limited by like what are reasonable cavities to build in laboratories. And so yeah, you have your axion come in, it interacts with the magnetic field, it turns into a photon, you detect the photon. The power that ADMX detects is proportional to the coupling squared, the volume, the magnetic field, the dark matter density. This is some form factor for the cavity divided by the mass. And here is the quality factor for the cavity. So if as you go off resonance, this goes down, so you can't detect them. For their kind of fiducial parameters, what is ADMX? It's a 500 liter cavity, 7 tesla magnetic field. And at 10 to the 12 GeV, which is the mass they aim for, the power that you create in that cavity is 10 to the minus 21 watts. And that's what they're attempting to detect. The design sensitivity is going to cover about an order of magnitude in axion mass for both the DFSZ and KSVZ axions. It's the classic window for axion dark matter. You get order one contribution from vacuum realignment with no fine tuning. It's all very nice. But you can't really, with an experiment like this, go outside of this mass range very much because you're limited by the physical size of your cavity. And trying to go a little bit beyond that, how can we start thinking of other ways to directly detect axions? So let's just start with, why is this so different from the game of detecting WIMPs, for example? So different because the galactic dark matter is a coherently oscillating condensate. So the field has some oscillating piece where it just oscillates at the frequency set by the mass, and then it has some time and space dependent part.
Can I just interrupt? You said that the expectation value, or like the amplitude, is 10 to the 10 G. Uh-huh. Divided by a phase, which is 10 to the 17 G, I get 10 minus 7.
Yeah.
And it should multiply by the mass of the axion to get the two energy units for any effect, right? It would be below 10 minus. Which is exceedingly small for anything that there is no photographic detection of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it looks hopeless, okay.
It's worth looking for, worth seeing what you can do. So I'll show you what I talked about. I'm going to get onto the neutron EDM stuff, which you're in a fine-tuned region of parameter space, but if you were there, you can get it. So I'll get to that. Okay, so you've got this coherently oscillating field. It's oscillating at a frequency of about 10 to the minus 7 hertz, which is a timescale of 2.5 months. And yeah, the local dark matter density is just half m squared phi naught squared. And so you can use the local dark matter density 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed to work out what the field value is. That's what we were just talking about then. The coherence length inside this condensate is the de Broglie wavelength. So it's 1 over the mass times the virial velocity in the galaxy, which for this fiducial parameter is 0.2 kiloparsecs. So you've got these really large coherent patches of oscillating field. And the coherence time with which you go through those is 1 over mv squared, so it would be about 10 to the 6 years. So your detector, so if you're looking at these low mass galaxies, you're really just moving through, as the Earth moves around, you're really just moving through a coherent field that's oscillating at some constant amplitude. Okay, so you want to start thinking about detection of coherent effects caused by these low-frequency field oscillations. And there's a whole group of people thinking about things like this at the moment. Okay, so we've talked about E dot B, and the E dot B constraints tend to, not go down to very low frequencies. What can we do with nucleon interactions? So the two types of interaction you can have are your standard interaction with the color anomaly. And then you could have some axial nucleon current interaction. And both of these, you can ask, what the physical effects are, what are the constraints. So this leads to a neutron EDM with some coupling GD times the field. And for the QCD axion, GD is 10 to the minus 16 E centimeters over F. Okay, and this is the basis of the Petrograd mechanism. But by looking for, axion-like particles with a coupling like this, can you get any new constraints on them? Okay, for the coupling to nucleons, energy loss and the timing of the neutrino burst versus the photons from supernova 1987A puts a constraint on the nucleon coupling at the level of kind of 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV. This also leads to spin-dependent forces, and it leads to this axion wind spin precession effect, which I'm going to talk about. Okay, so I'm going to talk about possible new constraints on ALPS from this term and from this. Okay, I'm going to be talking about CASPER. So CASPER, this is an experiment proposed fairly recently by Peter Graham and co. It stands for the Cosmic Axion Spin Precession Experiment, and it uses nuclear magnetic resonance. So the idea is that you align your nuclear spins using some B field, and then in that external B field, they precess at the Lama frequency to mu B, where mu is the magnetic dipole moment. Okay, but if you couple to the electric dipole moment, or you couple to this nuclear spin with the axion wind, you have an additional precession in addition to the Lama frequency. And you get a resonance enhancement when the frequency of that additional precession, which is set by the mass, is equal to the Lama frequency. And so there are two versions of CASPER, which work in very similar ways. There's CASPER electric and CASPER wind.
This CASPER wind, there's no relation to whatever you're going to do, because your frequency is, as you say, 1 per 2.5 knots, right? I mean, so at the scale of the measurements, it's a constant thing, right?
Right, so you'd have to do a long...
No, but with that technology, this is absolutely the wrong technology for doing the 2.5-month periods, right? Because
oh yeah, so you're not on resonance.
It doesn't even exist. You've got to use atomic magnetometers, which is like used for looking for anomalous spin precession.
Mm-hmm.
With this technology, even if it's sort of advances to some decent space, you'd never be able to compete with atomic. So already now you can beat on this out bounds, as we discussed yesterday. But this has nothing to do with because you're not going to be doing this, right? The period is 2.2 months. You got to look for the constant.
I've got a whole slide on this coming up.
Right.
We've got a whole slide. If you hold your breath, it's coming up. Okay. And I'm not just interested in this mass range now, you know. I'm interested in what can you probe everywhere.
In mind, that's why they tried to do the resonance. So the whole thing here is to arrange the resonance on the absolute mass, but you cannot arrange the resonance if the oscillator.
You do a broadband search. I'm getting through all of it. It's a broadband. It would be a broadband, and I don't know how it would work, and I don't know what the other constraints are, and that's why I'm talking about it. Okay, so how does Casper Electric work? Okay, so you've got this oscillating dipole moment, and then that will lead to an additional spin precession if you apply an electric field. And the electric field is applied perpendicular to the magnetic field, and you get this additional spin precession, and you get a contribution to the bulk magnetization of the material, which you detect with the squid. In Casper Wind, you do essentially the same thing, but now just the role of the electric field is played by the dark matter wind. So you have this gradient coupling that couples the axion field to nuclear spins, and you apply the gradient to the axion field, and you get the velocity times the field. And so you get A. What is A? I've switched from A to phi. This should be a phi. There's just no A here at all. So now you've got this coupling, V dot sigma, where sigma is the nuclear spin. So now the dark matter wind just plays the role of the electric field. And you know what direction the dark matter wind's in. It's in the direction of Cygnus. And so you arrange your experiments such that you're perpendicular to the dark matter wind. You have a bulk magnetization, and you try and pick it up. These are the forecasted sensitivities for Casper. Casper Electric on the left, Casper Wind on the right. Casper Electric, so on both of these plots, this is this GD coupling and this is GN. The QCD axion is a line because both of these just scale with 1 over F. So it's mass versus coupling, and the mass is fixed by F, so the QCD axion's a line. ADMX lives here. There's a constraint. Okay, I'm going to come to the other constraints here in a minute. So with Casper Electric, the forecast is that you know, at the final stages of this experiment, they could start to put constraints on the QCD axion at very low mass. So this would be gut to Planck scale decay constants for the QCD axion that they could start to detect, which is just, you know, way, way away from what you could do with ADMX. So that looks quite nice. Something to point out here is that anywhere really above the QCD line here, you're lighter than the QCD axion, but you're just as strongly coupled to the color anomaly, so you'd have to cancel that contribution to the mass somehow. So stuff up here is fine tuned, but there's no reason, you know, not to run an experiment that could detect it, right? But it would be, you know, an amazing puzzle if you found anything there. The constraints on this GD coupling that they're showing, there's one from Supernova 1987A, which is, I don't know how they derived that, but I think it's just based on simple scaling of the energy loss arguments. Normally, these supernova constraints are only presented as the nucleon coupling and the photon coupling. I don't think they're normally expressed in terms of that coupling. And there's a constraint in the corner there from the static EDM experiments, and that's what I'm going to spend a little while talking about later, or very shortly, actually, which is, why do static EDM experiments give you a constraint on this plane? And all Graham and Rajendran did to get this constraint is they looked at the number, they looked at like some rough numbers in these papers and like made a guess. But of course, you want to do that analysis properly, and that's what I'm going to talk about in a minute. Casper Wind doesn't get down to the QCD axion line, but all of this parameter, none of this parameter space up here is fine-tuned, so Alps could definitely live up here. There are constraints from new forces, but they're nowhere near as strong as the astrophysical constraints. So this is the bit that you're going to tell me is wrong, Maxime. So I'm trying to say, okay, what would Casper Wind do at very low frequencies? So Casper Wind, they only showed their constraint, they only showed their sensitivity down to 10 to the minus 14.
Casper Wind is not the proper name for this business. The proper name would be Drever-Hughes experiments, and they exist from 1978.
But they did their forecast of sensitivity down to 10 to the minus 14 EV. Still going down, the sensitivity is still increasing. Sensitivity at 10 to the minus 14 EV is 10 to the minus 20 inverse GeV. So you're already putting constraints on a punk suppressed operator.
14 dB, this is like 10 hertz, right?
Yeah, 10 hertz.
Relatively rapid oscillations. You're talking about effects that are almost constant.
I've got the plot.
You mentioned you want resonance with something. So what is it that you want to resonate?
With the Lama frequency.
The ground papers, they want to organize, they want something that is tunable in a solid state system. So,
at the frequency of sound crossing or the something crossing the detector?
No, there is like the spin splitting that with a magnetic field that would be the same order as the axon.
Yeah, so the Lama frequency separates the spin up, spin down states, and so it's that frequency of that transition.
And then you say, I guess Maxim is saying that you cannot tune it down to low enough frequency.
If you let me finish,
okay.
I will continue to talk about this because I have a whole slide on it, which is this one. Okay, so their sensitivity is still increasing going to low mass, because they're assuming that they can stay on resonance, right? Okay, so you could do a broadband search where you no longer have to be on resonance. And I emailed Peter and I said, what's the sensitivity of Casper Wind in a broadband search? And he said, well, it's kind of still decreasing here, but maybe a conservative thing would just be to say constant sensitivity to lower masses in broadband. So that's what I've shown here, although the color hasn't shown up very well. And I know I'm going to now comment on why that's probably not the right thing to do. But Peter said, oh yeah, broadband search, that'll be roughly constant sensitivity from the lowest mass that we tune to. So if you go across as that constant, oh great, you can detect these models that we constructed with the discrete symmetry. 10 minutes, good. Okay, great, it looks like you might be able to do that. Why is that a problem? It's a huge extrapolation from the published limit. You'd need to have control over the noise sources of your magnetometer over those month timescales, which is like obviously really, really hard. There's gonna be some kind of 1/f noise that comes in at low frequency. But maybe that comes down a little bit further, maybe 1/f noise kicks in like that. No one's done a study of the sensitivity of these types of experiments to these really low frequencies. And I think just doing the most naive extrapolation and saying, hey, maybe you could get it, is reason enough to try and do this properly. So that looks kind of nice. In the last 10 minutes, I want to tell you about some new work that I'm doing, working with Philip Harris and co. On an actual neutron analysis of an actual neutron EDM experiment to search for axion-like particles. And here, I'm not tied to that mass. I'm just saying, like, this is a motivation to try and look at very low frequency and see what happens. But we're just going to look for ALPS on those two planes that I showed before, GD versus mass and GN versus mass, using existing data from neutron EDM experiments. So the neutron EDM experiment ran at Sussex, Rutherford Appleton, and Institut Loev-Langevin until 2006. And that is the best limit that you see quoted everywhere on the static neutron electric dipole moment. It has to be less than 10 to the minus 26 e centimeters.
Well, the experiment was at that level. It's just the collaborator, so it's sitting at Sussex.
Yeah. I think the original version of it was actually built by Philip at Sussex. There was like an old one, wasn't there, like 20 years before this? Oh, well, at RAL there is. At RAL there's neutrons. Okay, Rutherford Appleton. I think there was a version at Rutherford Appleton where they have neutrons. Okay, so what do they do? The energy splitting in the presence of a B field and an E field is this Lama frequency with the magnetic dipole moment of the neutron times B, times any possible electric dipole moment times E. And so this is a diagram of their experiment. The time scales to keep in mind when you think about this experiment and how can you use it to possibly constrain axion-like particles are cycles where the neutrons go in and then they freely process and they go in, they have an E field applied to them, and then they start freely processing. And they're left to do that for 130 seconds in each cycle. And then the new cycle happens where you flip the direction of the E field. And over the course of a run, they do that many, many times, and you measure the difference in the splittings for neutrons versus mercury in the E up, E down case. And over the course of a day, you do that a number of times, and you get a measurement for what you think the electric dipole moment of the neutron is on during each run, which is of order a day. So as I say, they actually use the ratio of the neutron to the mercury, because they know that they know the dipole moment of mercury. Okay, so they publish an average limit over the entire 3 years that they ran their data. And what Graham and Rajendran did to get that constraint that I showed you from static EDM is they just said, only consider the cycles, and say at the end of each cycle, you would just catch the end of an oscillation if your frequency was shorter than 130 inverse seconds, 1 over 130 seconds. You would just see the end of each oscillation, and so you would just see noise, and then they just said, oh, and just plug that in into the 95% constraint. Obviously, that's not like a proper analysis, and that's not proper statistics. But they were just doing estimates, and you can do better than that. And the number to keep in mind here is that these type of neutron EDM experiments are sensitive to energy shifts of order 10 to the minus 21 EV. So you can use that to estimate the kind of level of constraints you'll get from any particular shift to this energy. There's been an upgrade to the neutron EDM experiment operating at the Paul Scherrer Institute. The NEDM moved there in 2009. Their upgraded version of the experiment has been taking data for 6 months, and it aims for an order 10 improvement on the measurement of the static dipole moment. And so what we're doing is we're looking at the data from the previous experiment that ran for 3 years. And so you can just basically think of it taking a measurement of the EDM every day for 3 years, and you can just look for any oscillation in that and use that to constrain your possible coupling of your ELK. And then also the stuff at PSI hasn't got that same long timescale of measurement, but each run that they do has a much greater level of sensitivity. Okay, so what do we do? So this is work with the NEDM collaboration, plus a bunch of other theorists, Yevgeny Stadnik, Victor Flambaum, and Malcolm Fairbairn. Okay, so what they measure at these EDM experiments, they measure the ratio of the energy splittings of the neutron to mercury. And they fit a straight line function, so they have a dependence on E, and they have some constant intercept. In the standard case, the constant intercept is the ratio of the magnetic dipole moments, which is the ratio of the gyromagnetic ratios. And then you extract dN, you know d mercury, and so you fit the straight line here, and you extract dN. And you check that R is consistent. So cycle by cycle, you could fit this. If there was an axion wind effect, so this is kind of an offshoot of doing this analysis. I was talking with Maxime. This isn't the best way to constrain the axion wind thing, but you can do it just using the data that's there, so why not? So the axion wind would lead to an additional constant shift here, or an additional effect that is independent of E. And it would look like some off-axis B field. So it's something that doesn't depend on E. So they have B lined up with E. And they put constraints as a systematic on any B in X or Y, if Z is the direction collinear with E. And they claim that they control for that systematic at the and don't see it at the level of 0.1 of their best limit on dN. So you can convert that into what energy level that what energy shift they're controlling that down to, and get a very rough guess for what kind of constraint on G phi N you might get. 10 to the minus 8 inverse GeV. Not as good as the supernova limits, but better than the direct constraints on spin-dependent forces, and it's in the lab. That's kind of nice. That's an offshoot of what you can do from doing an analysis like this. And that's assuming, you know, you just don't know what direction this is in, right? It's just some B, X, Y, and they don't know what direction it's in. When you're actually fitting it, you do know the direction it's in. It should be in the direction of the dark matter wind, and it should have a very particular directional and time dependence caused by the sidereal modulation. And so you can try. And so I think that, you know, when you fit the right function, you know where your spins, where you might get a slightly better constraint than this, because it's a very particular a very particular astrophysical origin. You've got to control how well do I know the direction of my neutron spins relative to this astrophysical direction, but you might do better than this. The main thing that we want to do with this data is try and constrain this GD coupling. It gives you an oscillating signal. On the timescale of the cycles, you'd be seeing whether there's an oscillation in this gradient here. On the timescale of the runs, you can just look at the measurements of dn from each run and try and fit that data with a sign and get a constraint on GD. By having now looked at this data, run by run from the ILL, the limit on dn day to day is about 10 times worse than the overall limit from 3 years. And so you can just say, well, if there's no signal, what amplitude do I have to be below to have not produced something that you would have just seen in that day-to-day data, obviously. And you get a constraint on GD of about 10 to the minus 22 inverse GeV times the mass inverse GeV squared, which, you know, if you had an order one coupling to the color anomaly, F would have to be larger than the Planck scale to get a coupling down there. But of course, like I said, at these low masses, it's a very fine-tuned part of parameter space, but you can search for it and you can put a constraint on it. It looks like it will be, you know, the best constraints on this parameter. So that's pretty fun. I'm at the end of my time, so I am not going to tell you about the future of trying to push that mass bound with cosmology, but we might be able to do it with lensing and CMBS4. And I'm not going to tell you about any of this other stuff to get to higher masses. And I'll end you with some nice plots. Thank you.
So what was the bottom line? I got there is that the Maxine was a skeptic about the amplitude of the force. Is it? And we're coming back to it several slides, but in the end of the day, the punchline is
okay. So the coupling that you got
for these light guys, there's no, you know, it just goes as 1/F. So whatever F is, it's order one. That the constraints that Casper Wind would get correspond to 1/F slightly larger than the Planck scale at 10 to the minus 14 EV. So they would constrain couplings of that magnitude at higher masses than what I was interested in. The thing that's the skeptical thing, which I'm also skeptical about, is I did this flat extrapolation to lower frequencies, assuming a broadband search.
Why do you need to do any extrapolation where specific experiments exist looking for the coupling of a screen to a constant direction, right?
I didn't know these experiments existed until you just told me.
Since, you know, Drever and Hughes, and it's been generation after generation improvements at Harvard by Wurzburg. Mangle with his last name, but also by Steve Lamoureux, by Mike Ramalis. This is a well, you know, known industry. And Ramalis in particular is the most sensitive point. So his response of his magnetometers is on the second kind of time frame. So anything, you know, that is
larger than a second,
with a, you know, period longer than a second, but he would take, right? And they would be not at the level 10 minus 8 GeV, but at the level of 10 to 10, maybe 10 to 11 GeV.
So on that plot where he was going horizontally over, it'd be higher than that.
That's a supernova constraint, right?
I saw this plot, because he was showing this plot from Rajendran and all paper, which was for resonant detection, right? So we're not talking about the fact that it's constant, right? So these guys are looking just for 24-hour modulation of their, you know, if there is coupling of spins to some odd direction, and your magnetic field oscillates. I mean, not oscillates, but rotates 24 hours.
That axis was a F with the K constant, right? So is there existing sensitivity much worse than the Dowdy's extrapolation?
I do not understand why.
Yeah, but you don't need to. If I just ask for it.
I can, I'll draw the plot. Let me draw the plot for you and try and tell you what I think is going on. Okay, so let's say that this is what it, just 1 over the decay constant, right?
Yeah.
Supernova is 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV.
Mm-hmm.
At 10 to the minus 14 EV for the mass, which is 10 hertz. Graham and Regendron claim that Casper using the resonant search will get down here, which is 10 to the minus 20 inverse GeV. So
my question, instead of asking it, is...
So then the stuff that Maxime's saying Maxime's will be like here.
So that stops for Maxime. Where is the bound that exists from these experiments on that plot?
It would be at the level of 10 to minus 10 GeV for the constant phase.
Yeah, so that would be on masses of, you know, anything larger than about a second. So it would be like 10 to the minus 15 from those down to some mass at which they can control their backgrounds and keep things stable, you know, maybe like a day or so. And it would be slightly better than the supernova bounds. But what the Casper extrapolation I did, I extrapolated Casper as a straight line for some broadband search. And Peter thought it would actually go...
It doesn't make any sense that the broadband search should be as sensitive as a resonant search, because you're gaining from... I mean, there's a reason they're doing the resonance, right? So it might be flat, but it should be higher.
As I said, I did what Peter told me to do. Because I just wanted to say, I put my models on this plane, what can constrain them, what are your sensitivities?
Look.
And so
let's
I think it should be done.
Math in our heads, right? So you just said 10 to the minus 22 eV, the mass of your atom, right? The field you told me is 10 to the 10 GeV, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your phase what? 10 to the you say you want to be sensitive to 10 to the 20 GeV.
Okay, let me do the math what you were saying. So at my mass, the level that I said I would get a constraint from any DM from the ILL stuff, that would be a constraint of about 10 to the minus 8 inverse GeV. And they are measuring delta E of order 10 to the minus 21 EV.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to come down 10 orders of magnitude from there, you would be looking for something that can do delta E of 10 to the minus 31. And that's what you're saying was really, really hard. That's the maths you were about to do with this.
This is just saying that you can measure the energy splittings between speeds that are just almost comparable to the Hubble expansion rate, right? Because there's no way right now in the current technology, let me express my doubts about, Peter's Rigid schemes as well, because this looks unreal at this point.
Yeah, so we're somewhere up here, though, which was above the extrapolation from them. And so it would come down and it would come up, and where would it go? Nobody knows.
We know, right? Because there are generation of experimentalists, not theorists, experimentalists, working on this, right? With the best atomic magnetometers, right?
And you're saying it's still orders of magnitude.
It would be at the level of 10 to minus 10 GeV, right? Exactly.
Right, which would be delta E of like 10 to the minus 24 or something.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
it's still much further than this.
Right.
That's what you're saying.
Sure. This will be many orders of magnitude gap to that number, yeah. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
So
but I wonder if there's some experiment that you can do that can get you there.
Measuring the dissipative temperature, is that what I guess the
thing? Maybe we can continue this discussion if people are interested, but any other questions? Let's thank Doug again.